You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa on this beautiful day in August.
Indeed.
This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone, and this is a... You really want to hear this, and you're going to want to tell all your friends, if they can't hear today, to listen to Monday's rebroadcast.
Monday morning, 8 a.m. We broadcast live Fridays at 1 Central, also live streaming at KRUUFM.com. We have two really wonderful guests today, both of whom are making a mark in the world, I think.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes.
So who do we have up first?
Okay, first of all, we have a gentleman who has written a book called Being the Change: Live Well and a Spark in Climate Revolution. Peter, how do you pronounce it?
Thomas. He says Thomas with a K. Peter Thomas.
And this is an interesting book. It's full. There's so many things in it. You start reading and you just think, oh my gosh, yeah, that's right. And then, you know.
And Peter's an atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab with a PhD in physics from Columbia University, but he's speaking and writing on his own behalf, not on NASA's.
Yes.
And he lives in suburban Altadena, California, with his wife and two children on 1/10 the fossil fuels of the average American.
And he has several ways in which you do that. And they are very interesting.
And some of the ways he writes about remind us a little bit of someone who's not with us anymore.
Yeah, Monica's father. he was way beyond his...
He was, in the 70s, 60s and 70s, he was definitely not a hippie, but he was into the back to the land movement sustainable living before that was what it was called. And in a sense, I think that's what this book is about, Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Peter.
Well, thanks so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Now, sustainable living is actually... a word that we use a lot around here. The local Maharishi University of Management has a sustainable living degree program. A lot of focus on it. I'm on the, or was until quite recently, on the board of the Sustainable Living Coalition. So it's a topic of great interest in our little town here. Have you ever been to Fairfield?
No, I haven't. But we do drive through Iowa sometimes when we travel from Los Angeles to visit our parents in Illinois. So my wife actually hails from Sterling, Illinois, which is pretty close to the Quad Cities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not far.
No, we're not far from the Quad Cities, so hop down here sometime.
So
next time we come, I can come visit.
Good. Have you heard about Fairfield before?
No, I haven't. It sounds like a lovely community. I love the fact that your station is powered by solar electricity.
It is.
We're broadcasting with solar power now.
That's right, and I think it's one of the only radio stations in the world, or at least in the United States, that does this. So do you talk about solar power in your book?
A little bit. You know, it's interesting. One of the early things that I thought about doing as I was navigating my own changes was to put solar panels on my roof. I mean, it's extremely sunny here. It's probably one of the most sunny locations in the United States. So solar makes a lot of sense here. But we use too little electricity to make that worthwhile. So none of the solar lease companies would be willing to do that. They didn't have systems that were small enough for us and that would make economic sense. And the payback period, would have been like 40 years or something. And I simply purchased renewable electricity from my utility when they finally offered it about a year ago. So I lived here for 8 years with fossil fuel electricity before they finally offered that, unfortunately. And now I push for something called community choice aggregation, which is a program available in some states, including California and Illinois. I'm not sure about Iowa, but it's a way that communities can actually band together, so coalitions of cities and counties, and decide how they would like to produce their electricity. And then the utility, by law, the existing utility, is required to carry it and deliver it through their existing infrastructure and then provide the billing services. So this is a way for communities to create, medium-scale to large-scale solar projects. For example, keep those jobs and keep that, you know, keep those projects within their community. Make them, make visible projects that are on the front lines of you know, communities that are maybe being overlooked in the larger kind of climate action movement. So it's a wonderful way for communities to kind of become more conscious about how their electricity is produced. And then, you know, in one fell swoop, all of Los Angeles County, for example, can become renewable. So I thought that was more important than...
Than your individual...
Struggling with my own rooftop, which it just didn't... Unfortunately for us, it just didn't make sense.
And is that community aggregation happening anywhere? Has it been implemented?
Yeah, it was. Early adopters were Marin County and Sonoma County, a little bit further north of us. And what they found was that they could generate renewable electricity at a much higher fraction of renewable, and sell it for cheaper to their customers than the for-profit utility could manage. So it was kind of a no-brainer. It was a win-win. And Los Angeles is implementing a similar CCA, which we'll start switching over to that in 2018. So it's coming quite soon.
Wow,
that is really great.
Well, in Iowa, we've been really forward with the wind power. I believe something like 25% of our electricity is now generated by wind in the state of Iowa, mostly in northern Iowa, which is very windy.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, down here in southern Iowa, we have two very strong solar energy companies here in Fairfield. I am invested in a couple of commercial buildings that has solar, that we have the solar rooftop panels, but they can't produce 100% of the electricity needed by the building. At times it's 100% or even more, and fortunately we still have net metering here, which means basically that when we're producing more than we use, it feeds into the grid. But other times, you know, it's...
So storage is going to be a big part of this transition, as will being able to more easily move electricity from region to region. So when one region is overproducing, other regions can use it.
Now, your book is focused really more on what you as an individual, how you changed your life and ways that weren't painful for you.
Right. So, you know, of course, there is, I think, an intimate connection between individual change and collective change. So I view society as a sort of a kind of like a wave where individuals are the water molecules, and we all kind of make up the culture, and we're moved by the culture, and we move the culture. But yeah, I grew in awareness about global warming. I started out as an astrophysicist, and as my awareness grew, I was getting so distracted thinking about climate science that I finally realized I had to make a career shift. And then I started to realize that I was contributing to the problem myself by burning fossil fuels, and I wanted to explore ways to use less fossil fuel in my own life. So I started by quantifying how I was producing those emissions, where they were coming from. I realized a lot of my emissions were coming from flying, because scientists fly a lot. So this was in around 2010, and I was flying about 50,000 miles a year. And so I started reducing my flying. I started biking, which I genuinely enjoy, and my wife enjoys as well. And it helps keep us healthy, and it helps keep us more connected to the community. And it's just, frankly, just a really joyful thing to be going down a hill in the open air on a bicycle. We started growing food. So while flying was the biggest source of my own emissions, it turned out that my diet was the second biggest source. And both of those things were big surprises for me that I wouldn't have ever known if I hadn't actually just sat down and worked it out. So I started changing how I got my food. I switched to vegetarianism, which strangely caused food to actually start tasting better to me, and made me feel like I had more energy. And growing food, which tastes wonderful. You know, there's a huge variety of fruit trees that we can grow here in suburban Los Angeles. So I've got pomegranates that are ripe right now, figs that are ripe, the oranges and lemons and grapefruits finished. Avocados will be, that's my favorite tree, the avocado tree, and it's going to be producing a huge crop, which we'll start being able to harvest in a couple of months. So, so I really enjoy these changes.
Yeah, well, of course, in Southern California, fine, but there's a lot of places that we don't have that opportunity. But I suppose we can adjust by planting other things that we can use.
Right, you can't grow oranges there, but you can definitely grow apples, and you can grow
plums, pears,
and
peaches.
Lots of things.
One of the things, when you talk about riding your bike, one of the things that always shocks me is, even in the small town, but certainly in the city, how many people will get in the car to drive a mile to the gym to work out?
Mm-hmm. I think it just stems from a lack of awareness. Essentially, they just don't know what they're missing, and it's unfortunate. I think a lot of people who don't bike, if they tried it, they sort of have the same discovery that I made, that it's just really fun to use your body to move through space.
It is, and when I bike both here, and I also live part-time in Austin, and there I don't own a bike, but I use the bike share program, and I love being able to get from here to there and with just under my own power. Now, the thing that holds me back besides weather in Iowa a lot of times is time. You know, we're rushing from one thing to the next. I've got an appointment here, a meeting here, and I feel like I just don't have the time to bike from place to place. How do you deal with that?
I think that's so, that's such a big part of this picture, is that, you know, we live, in my opinion, a life that's too fast-paced, and I think that we'd be happier if we slow down a little bit, and fossil fuels literally fuel this frenetic moving around really quickly, and it, all the noise from it, you know, we have lots of helicopters going over our house here, noise from freeways, and, you know, I guess I'm just sort of a turning into one of those people who prefers things to go a little more slowly and to be a little bit more quiet. I really enjoy silence and stillness. So, I'm that's part of why, you know, I'm advocating for a shift away from fossil fuels. I think we'd all benefit from slowing down a little bit.
Yeah. So, what made you decide to write this book, Peter?
Right. So it was 2010, and like I said, I was surprised that a lot of these changes, as I gradually transitioned away from fossil fuels step by step, were actually causing me to feel more satisfaction and more connection with my community and more connection with the land and with my food supply. And so it was a very satisfying path, and I thought that that message needed to be shared, that a shift away from fossil fuels, especially when viewed in light of global warming and sort of the urgent need for this transition, so it becomes very meaningful to start pioneering this path and to start exploring this path. And I thought that was a message that wasn't being, I didn't see that being broadcast widely enough. So that was the main driver behind the book.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Peter Comas, author of Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution, which is now a feature documentary. Do you want to tell us about that, where we can watch it?
Yeah, well, it's not quite ready. It's hard making a documentary film, and so I think it's going to be ready in late fall. So I've been told November. And this should air on PBS, and it will probably be distributed by other channels, but I honestly am not sure how that's going to work since I've never been through this process before. But, you know, I'm excited for the film and a little bit apprehensive because this is such a politically charged topic. Even writing a book as a climate scientist felt a little bit frightening to me, you know, like I'm putting myself out there and speaking out. And kind of making myself a target in some sense. And the film, you know, which features my family, is more so. But I felt that, like I do with some, you know, speaking out in the book and going on your show, for example, you know, I'm so concerned about what we're doing as a species to this biosphere that gives us all life, that that I feel it's far more important for me to speak out than to have a safe career.
Now you do put a lot of science into this, don't you, into the book?
But yeah, there's two chapters that talk about the science behind global warming. I focused on giving sort of the basic story, how we know what we know, what we know and what we don't know, and what the uncertainties are, and what the timescales are. How quickly is this unfolding? How long will it last? I felt like this was important to give the book kind of to make it grounded in the science, in order to give it a sense of urgency that would maybe make some of my changes, give that more of a context, right? Because, you know, living on a tenth of fossil fuels could appear to some people to be a little bit extreme, but maybe when weighed against what we're doing and the urgency of change, maybe it's not extreme enough.
Wow. What do you recommend, you know, flying, as you said, is one of the largest culprits, but if you need to get from here to there, what do you do instead? Are you not going to bike cross country?
Well, you can bike cross country. Well, I actually did when after a summer job, when I was right after I graduated from college, I was working a summer job in New Mexico, and I didn't know what to do with my life after it ended. So I bought a bicycle from REI for $300 and rode home to Illinois to my parents' house, and it was one of the most fun things I've ever done in my life, and that's still the bicycle that I ride around today.
Oh my gosh,
it's a great bike. So you can do that. It's actually, you know, quite a bike doesn't go really that much slower than a car. So you know, you can go 100 miles in a day on a bike, and you know, if you have the time, that's actually a really healthy way to travel. We also, Illinois is a common place for us to go to because of our parents, of course, and I also have a sister there. And my wife has some family in the Twin Cities and in Wisconsin. So we drive on vegetable oil sometimes. We actually just finished the 3,500-mile trip up to the Pacific Northwest on vegetable oil. So I did a few book events, and I met the publisher, and we did see the eclipse in Oregon, which was amazing and fun.
Oh, wow.
And visited a lot of friends along the way, and we take the train sometimes, too. So the train in this country is certainly not as good as it could be. I think with a little bit of new infrastructure and a little bit of planning and design, we could easily have trains in this country that went twice as fast as what we have now. And we could make those trains electric and run them off of those wind turbines that you see, which would be fantastic. So there are definitely ways to travel without planes. Crossing oceans is a little bit more difficult, but that's possible as well, as I explain in the book. It just takes the shift in mindset, right? We need to think about travel as, just like food, as something that is precious, not something that we take for granted. And we have to be willing to do it in a slower and more connected and, in my opinion, more adventurous way.
Have you ever heard of RAGBRAI?
Of what? Of RAGBRAI, yes, of course. Yeah, I used to think about doing it, but unfortunately I never have. But it sounds like a great party to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's...
Have you guys done it?
No, it's a great adventure. My daughter-in-law does it, and she has she bikes with a group, which is a good idea. I've also had some friends who had unfortunate accidents, because when you're all these bicyclists and somebody drops something and then they get off their bike to pick it up, then it's a, you know, it's a bad deal. But so there has to be...
Yeah, and, you know, I get a lot of sort of pushback about the biking because of people who are concerned about accidents. And, you know, probably the most serious accident I had was on a bicycle when I was, I think it was when I was in eighth grade, so I was quite young and I wasn't paying attention. And I was riding at night without a light.
Ah.
You do have to be very careful, and you do have to bike in a smart way. But one of the big surprises that I discovered when I was writing this book is that if you look at all causes of mortality in a statistical way, you know, the way actuaries do. Biking is actually safer than driving. If you do a, like, say, a 5-mile bike commute, or even a 2-mile bike commute one way, the benefits of reduced heart disease, which is, you know, such a dangerous thing as we age, so heart attacks and strokes, the reduced risk from dying from heart disease far, far outweighs the risk from injuries. It's like a factor of 10 to 1 or something. So,
wow.
So biking is actually safer when you look at it in a more holistic way.
Now, here in Fairfield, they have bike trails, don't they?
We have a great bike trail around the city. It was a lot of its old reclaimed railroad bed.
But I mean, even on the streets.
Oh, yeah, along the streets, too, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And as more people bike, it'll become safer because drivers will start to see bicyclists more. That's called the safety in numbers effect.
Mm.
And infrastructure, better, safer infrastructure, bike infrastructure will follow as more people start to get on those bikes.
What do you think of electric bikes?
I think they're great. I don't have one myself, but I have a lot of friends who have them, and they absolutely love them. So, yeah, I think they're fantastic.
My brother Joel just got one so he can keep up with his wife, the Ragri rider.
Well, there's a man that goes by.
It's far easier to electrify a bike than it is to electrify a car, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
There's a man that goes by my house, and it looks like he's skiing. He's riding a bike, but it looks like he's skiing.
I don't know what that bike is,
but he can go pretty fast on it, I'll tell you.
Well, Peter, we don't have a lot of time left. Let's talk a little bit about when you were writing the book, how did you decide what to put in and what to leave out, and what's kind of the overall structure of this book?
Okay, so the structure is pretty much, I think, maybe what you would expect. It's got two parts. The first part is called Predicament. So that describes the interconnected predicament that we have, of which global warming is probably the most urgent and severe symptom. So this includes overpopulation. You know, I think I agree with most experts that the number of people on the planet living the way that we're living has exceeded the Earth's carrying capacity. And exponential growth mindset, this need that we have for an economy to always be growing exponentially, otherwise, you know, we face recession, and that's just not a good design for an economy on a finite planet. So we need to start thinking about how to move beyond that somehow to a steady-state economy. And the second part of the book is called A Mammal in the Biosphere. So this part was more fun for me to write. It was the first part took a lot of research, and you know, some of the research was, you had to think about topsoil depletion and aquifer depletion, and some of it was a little frightening for me to be constantly thinking about that stuff, to be honest. The second part is about what one individual can do in the face of this predicament. And that was the key question, which was another motivator for me to write this book, because I hadn't seen that addressed in a way that I found personally satisfying and meaningful anywhere in the literature. So I was reading a lot and looking far and wide. And,
well, you really did hit the spot on that, because it's fine to talk about something, but if you can really put it into practice, that's the key.
Yeah, and the fact is, you know, we'd all love to save the world, but all we can really do is change the world, which we're all doing every day, whether we're aware of it or not.
Right.
And we're all limited. Like, we're single human animals in this vast biosphere, which is facing this vast predicament from our collective action. So what can we do that's, you know, goes way beyond recycling and changing our light bulbs? What can we do that's really meaningful to grapple with this problem? There's certainly existential elements here, or if you would prefer, maybe spiritual elements, because it affects so deeply how we interact with this biosphere, how we live our lives, how we interact as a community. And, you know, we're causing the sixth mass extinction and displacing non-humans from this planet. And to me, that's a very sad thing. That affects me at an emotional level.
Right.
So, the second part is grappling with these issues. And, you know, I speak in the first person and discuss the changes that I made, which, you know, some of them might resonate with various readers and some of them might not. And I hope that readers find their own ways for responding to this. And, you know, then as a community, we can start to have this discussion and help each other along the path. Right.
Peter, in the couple minutes we have left, let's talk a little bit more about the food issue, because I think you are surprised, and I'm surprised, that that is the second largest culprit for most people. Is it mainly the transportation of food that's causing that, or how it's produced in the first place?
It's all of the above. So producing meat animal agriculture accounts for about 10 to 20%, so maybe around 15% of the total greenhouse gas burden. So about 15% of global warming is due from animal agriculture, but that comes also from clearing forests to create pastures. It comes from, using nitrogen to make fertilizer, which then becomes nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas, to grow the grain that we feed the animals and so forth. And then, of course, there's processing, there's packaging, there's transportation of the food.
Yeah, so it goes on and on. Yeah.
Basically, use fossil fuel to create a food system that, allows maybe 1% of us or less in the United States to actually participate in the production of food, whereas maybe 100 years ago, almost half of us were involved in some way in food production. So, maybe in the name of convenience, we've become detached from our food production. And in my opinion, there is a permaculturist named Fukuoka who says that in his opinion, if 100% of people were growing food, it would be ideal. And I think that this whole food discussion is really closely tied to global warming.
And growing your own food or going to farmers markets for local, supporting locally grown food, I think.
Yeah, I'm becoming more aware of food, and maybe I found a way to dip into the waste stream, which maybe not everyone, that's a good example of something that not everyone might be willing to do, but I really enjoy that. So, wasting less food, growing more food, trading with neighbors. So when I have way too many avocados for my family, I trade that with neighbors who are growing other things that I'm not growing. So this builds community too. I mean, there's a lot of connection between growing food and growing community.
Wow. Yep.
So I just want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Peter Kalmus, author of Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution. And this book is available wherever books are sold. And do you have a website for the book?
Yeah, it's beingthechangebook.com, and people can contact me through that website if they like.
Great.
Well, I highly recommend this book. I mean, it's just full of all kinds of things that you can do.
And there's a whole lot more we could get into, like the whole humanure aspect.
Yeah.
That was a little bit of a surprise. Just let me ask real quickly, is your toilet indoors or out?
It used to be indoors, and now it's outdoors. We actually built a kind of outdoor shower, and we made it big enough to put the, we call it the leaf toilet, to put that out there. So now we have two bathrooms, because that was a big gripe of my wife's, actually, that we only had one bathroom in the house.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Peter. And we need to make room now, make time for our next guest. And Mom, do you have a closing quote
I
for
do.
This?
You know, the problem is that there's so many people that just don't want to believe this, because most human beings have an almost infinite capacity for taking things for granted, like, this is the way it is. Let's just, Yeah, right.
All right. Thank you, Peter. And we'll look forward to the documentary on PBS for Being the Change.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
All right. And now we will get our next guest on the line.
Thank you.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're back on the air. And our second guest has not made his appearance yet, so hopefully he's going to call in momentarily. And in the meantime, Mom, why don't you tell us who we hope we're going to be talking to for the second half hour today?
Well, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name.
I'd say Pasricha.
Pasricha, okay, yeah. Neil Pasricha. And Neil is a New York Times bestseller author of The Happiness Equation, The Book of Awesome, and The Journal of Awesome. He's a Harvard MBA, one of the most popular TED speakers of all time, and founder of the Institute for Global Happiness. He has dedicated the past 15 years of his life to developing leaders creating global programs inside the world's largest companies and speaking to hundreds of thousands of people around the world. He lives in Toronto with his wife and son, and I certainly does hope he calls.
So Neil's books include, you know, The Happiness Equation, The Book of Awesome, and The Journal of Awesome. And I listened to his TED Talk where he spoke about how this whole thing started, which was a blog that he started writing when he was kind of having a rough time. And he began blogging every day about something awesome. So it was 1,000 awesome things. So for 1,000 days, he blogged about something awesome. And I'm going to pull up that site so we can read a little bit from it. But while I'm doing that, Mom, do you want to read from this book, which is 2-Minute Mornings, A Journal to Win Your Day Every Day? So
every
kind
day.
Of what the purpose
every
of this
day.
Book
yeah.
is.
So what you're going to do is, you're going to, every day when you wake up, you write down in the first 2 minutes of your day what I will let go of, what I'm grateful for, and I will focus on whatever it is you're going to focus on that day, whether it's work or relaxation or getting in touch with somebody that you haven't talked to for a long time. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities there. So he says, the difference in my life was both immediate and incredible. The 2 minutes helped me suddenly win the morning, which helped start momentum toward me winning the day. Let go of something stressful helped me avoid mentally revisiting a worry throughout the day. The gratitude helped me be more positive every morning, and by deciding what to focus on, I helped align my goals and made sure I was investing in myself. These 2 minutes helped make sure I was going in the right direction, in the right frame of mind. 2 minutes. 2 minutes. Now, of course, the more you do this, the more you will realize what you need to focus on and what you need to let go of and what you're grateful for. I mean, you know, it's like anything else. The more you do it, the more involved you get. And so he says, if you're not already sold, scientific research supports the positive effect of all these actions. And so there's this little book. It's about half the size of a regular size book, I guess. It's hardcover, and it's a nice yellow cover with a blue printing on it. And it says 2-Minute Mornings, A Journal to Win Your Day Every Day.
Now, Neil, his blog is 1000awesomethings.com, and I'm going to read a little bit from the intro to that. He says, I wrote an entry on this site for 1,000 straight weekdays from 2008 to 2012 while processing the loss of my marriage and a close friend. This blog was my home, my community, and in a lot of ways, my therapy. After this post went viral, the site exploded and won best blog in the world 2 years in a row, scoring over 50 million hits, turning into a series of books, and getting me invited to do a TED Talk to speak to royal families and travel around the world talking about the power of optimism. I mean, this sounds like a dream come true, doesn't it? And then
really,
he says,
really.
Although it sounds exotic and sexy, it honestly became too much. I lost 40 pounds due to stress and wasn't eating or sleeping well during this time. I was processing those losses and working a full-time job at Walmart the whole time, writing every night, writing every weekend, saying no to every invitation, relationship, and outside the blog opportunity that came my way. Eventually, I wised up and shifted from observing simple pleasures to simply living them. I started saying yes. I started dating again. I started reconnecting, and I eventually met someone new. And out of that came, he says, now in my life, I'm focused on new projects like the Institute for Global Happiness, speaking about positive mindset, and most importantly, raising a family with Leslie. As I write this, our first son is 2 years old, and hopefully this will be Neil.
Okay. If it's not, I can go through his book here and tell us some things.
KRUU, this is Writer's Voices. Hello?
Hi, this is Neil Pasricha calling in.
Ah, yay! So I was just reading about how you got to this point in your life. I was reading the intro from your blog, 1,000 Awesome Things. So, and we've already told our listeners about 2-Minute Mornings and what the purpose of it is. What made you decide to put this journal out?
You know what? I was actually a frenetic, stressed-out person. I'm waking up in the morning with a million things to do, feeling anxious at the end of the day when I don't get through half my list. So the root reason I started 2-Minute Mornings was because I personally needed a cue card. Using a black Sharpie, I would write down, at most, 3 things to do that day. I'd leave that cue card in my pocket, so whenever I started going off the rails and thinking the news websites and answering text messages, I'd pull the card out of my pocket and get back on.
Mm.
If I limited it to 3, I would more likely than not get it done. Using that cue card became so important to me. I touched it all day, it was in my pocket all day, and I eventually realized the other side was blank. You know, I was always pulling up the wrong side. So I started writing on the back of it a few things I was happy about that day. Cold popsicle on a hot day. My kids slept in past 5 in the morning. Whatever it was, smell of the cinnamon bun at the train station. I would just sort of write a few things so that whenever I pulled up the wrong way, I had a few things that made me happy. It became a practice that I came to rely on. And it took a couple minutes. So the only thing I added to it over the years was removing, this is a bit embarrassing to admit, but it was like a confession chamber. I would write down, before I even wrote my 3 things, I would write down something I wanted to let go of or something that was making me anxious overnight. And as you can probably tell from me telling you the story, I always had something. 5 extra pounds of belly fat, or comparing myself to someone much more successful than I was, or, you know, some tiny minor anxiety which appeared large at nighttime. I would just write that, and the act of crystallizing it removed it from floating in the mental screensaver background of my brain all day. Those 3 practices, removing an anxiety, writing down a few things I was grateful for, and writing down 3 things to focus on, became my 2-minute morning practice. And this journal, 2-minute morning, simply codifies it and sort of shares that with the world.
So you have some advice in here, too, about how to choose your things to focus, your 3 things to focus on, some categories, perhaps, that are important. And do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Sure. This is the biggest problem in life right now. You know, we are making, on average, 295 decisions a day. Did my own research for The Happiness Equation, the book I wrote last year, and this is how many decisions we're making. And if that doesn't scare you enough, there's new research out from a company called Z-Score that shows that we are touching our cell phone an average of 2,500 times a day.
What?
That
not me.
All right, there's somebody who's touching theirs a whole lot more.
Yeah, and you know what? People play with it, right? Like, they play with it like it's become the fidget. It's become the fidget device. And so the distractions that we all have in our life are compounding and exponentially increasing. And so how do you make your list of 3? Well, that's going to feel painful, especially at the beginning. You'll have to prioritize everything you're doing. For me, I'd have, 15 to 25 things on a daily basis. And then I just have to pick off the 3 that matter the most. The pain is seeing the other 22 things fall off the list, knowing that I'm not going to do them. That feels hard. And if you can come up with a prioritized list and do three things, then you feel awesome at the end of the day because you got it done. The problem that I was having was I ended up going, you know, 1 mile an hour in a million different directions.
Mm.
End up moving tons of projects forward, but you don't get anything complete. And you end up, you end your day feeling like a failure.
You know, I sometimes do something and then put it on my to-do list so I can check it off. when it wasn't there to begin with.
Exactly. Right to-do list. Done.
So, one of the things that you talk about as a potential things to do to focus on today is random kindness. Why is that important?
Yeah, you know what? I talk a lot about happiness and what makes us happy. That's kind of the basis of all my work and research. And I don't know if you already shared with your listeners, but, you know, for me, my wife left me, you know, when I was 29 years old. She met someone else, and a couple weeks later, my best friend took his own life. And it was in that period of my life, as I was searching for happiness, that I started writing down one awesome thing a day on my blog. I did that for 1,000 straight days. I did it for myself, to cheer myself up, and eventually for the world, because the blog hit 50 million people, and it turned into this book, The Book of Awesome. And after that, I got put on a pedestal. You know, people were sending me around the world to give TED Talks and talk to royal families and all this stuff. People said, this guy's always happy. This guy's super awesome. I wasn't super happy. I was the pain that actually created the book that people liked. So I actually said to myself, okay, I got to start doing research. I got to figure out what actually makes people happy. I'm going to be asked those questions.
Mm.
Spent a few years going deep into positive psychology. And the study that results in the greatest increase of happiness more than anything else is done by Sonia Lobomirsky at Stanford. And she shows that doing 5 random acts of kindness a week for other people, ironically, increases your happiness more than anything else.
Hmm.
And that means more than exercise, more than meditation, more than writing down gratitude, more than journaling. All the things I'm listing really do help. But random acts of kindness, paying for someone's coffee, you know, filling up a parking meter, calling someone and just telling them you love them, writing a 3-sentence email to your old boss saying, I really appreciate this thing you taught me 5 years ago. These things make more of a difference than anything else that we do.
And part of that, of course, is because you are impacting other people and, you know, by your kindness and making them feel better, and maybe they're going to pass that on.
That's right.
You go so far as to say, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you there. I would even go so far as to say it's our own egos that make that work. So, you know, sometimes I'm on a stage talking to 1,000 people, and I say, the guy that holds the door open for all of us who leave this room, 1,000 people smile at him. 1,000 people, you know, or maybe 100 of those people say, thank you. 5 of them say, hey, you're a nice guy. I appreciate this. So that person, in like 2 minutes of holding a door for people, has just been told like 1,000 times that they're awesome.
It's true. They, you know, it's like the saying, it's better to give than to receive. And that's why, because you get to feel good about yourself.
Exactly.
You know, I had an experience recently, and this is, you know, kindness going in all directions, I guess. I had a woman who had been my, you know, she's a former niece. I was married to her uncle, and I had known her from the time she was about 7 years old until she was in her 20s, and had not had any contact with her in many, many years. She called me out of the blue to tell me, I mean, this is like 30 years later. She called to tell me that one time I had given her some money so that she could go to her senior prom. And I had told her she didn't need to pay it back, but that someday she could help somebody else. And she told me about the different times or that she had done that, and she always told the people about me.
Oh, wow.
And one of the most recent ones was an employee of hers who needed new tires, and she gave him the money to new tires, and she told him about me, and then he turned around and gave the money to somebody else when he could afford it. So it's like...
Yeah, pay it forward.
Three generations down, and it just was so cool to hear that.
We don't always get to hear that, but that was really, really good of her to call you and tell you that.
Yeah.
You got positive feedback for something you not only did a long time ago, but also forgot about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like nothing you could have invested your money in or your time in could pay such a large dividend, right?
That is absolutely true.
So it's huge.
So, Neil, tell us a little bit more about your institute, the Institute of Happiness, or what's it called exactly?
Sure, yeah. I started an organization called the Institute for Global Happiness.
Global Happiness.
This will tell you why. Mm-hmm. I found that the place we're spending most of our time, say the more hours than anywhere else, is also the same place that we are the least happy, which is shocking. So it maybe it won't surprise some of your listeners. It's work. Okay? So people are spending more time than anything else at work. And if you ask them to rank where they're happiest, work is at the bottom. Everything else is higher. Exercise, meditating, praying, listening to music, cooking, walking the dog, making love. Everything's a happier thing than work. So I'm looking at this big circle on a big chart done by Professor Matt Killingsworth at Harvard. I'm thinking, wait a minute, I have 10 years of HR experience. That's what I did. I did that until last year. I was director of leadership development inside Walmart. And it's for the time, and I guess till now, it's the world's largest company. So all I've been doing is figuring out how do you grow and develop leaders. Meanwhile, outside of work, I've been writing the Book of Awesome, writing the Happiness Equation. So I thought, I'm going to marry these two things together. And so now if you go to globalhappiness.org, the Institute, all I do there is put out free resources for people inside companies who want free workshops, free articles, free tools, anything that increases engagement, morale, and happiness inside the company. So that's what I'm dedicating my time towards. And what I do is really write these books, and I luckily get a chance to spread them, share them with people. And, of course, if you go to the website, you can download free chapters and everything for free on that.
So... did you always think that you wanted to be a writer? I mean, you went into HR, and so writing doesn't, you know, seem like an obvious next career step from HR. Did you always want to write?
No, I mean, I didn't. It was really channeling the pain I was feeling after my marriage ended, and I lost my best friend, Chris, who suffered from severe mental illness. Ended up taking his own life. So I started up a website called What Bounced and All the Things. I wasn't a writer. Wouldn't have called myself a writer. Didn't know how to use a semicolon.
Do you now?
I literally typed in how to start a blog, Google, the I'm Feeling Lucky button. It took me to a website called WordPress. There was a big blue button that said, click here to start a blog. And then it said, do you want red or blue? You know, just ask me 5 questions. And 10 minutes later, I started a website called 1000awesomethings.com.
And how did you come up with that idea?
Writing up.
You know, why?
The idea was very creative at all.
Well, but still, it's like, what made you think to write a blog about awesome things?
Well, I guess I grew up as a nerd, so every Saturday morning as a child, my mom took me to the library, and I fell in love with books, like Encyclopedia Brown, the Hardy Boys, all my sister's babysitter clubs, and I loved reading. I loved it. I adored it. And so in high school and university, while I didn't take English courses, I did love writing for the school newspaper. newspaper, and it became an outlet for me, and a therapeutic outlet for me. But when I faced times of challenge, writing became a salvation. I didn't turn to friends or therapy right away. I turned to writing. Oh. I'd come home and write about waiters and waitresses who bring you free refills without asking, and old dangerous playground equipment. And like I said, I didn't think the idea was creative, because if you go on the internet and you type in, like, who's got a list of things they like, or things that are often, like, ever, like, there's millions of them. Different was, I took great care in it. I spent hours a day on it. My pieces were 500 to 1,000 words each, usually. They were, like, arguably well-written and well-edited. I had pictures on them. And I did it for 1,000 straight days.
And how long did it take before people started noticing? At what point did people start noticing your blog? We're having a little trouble with the phone connection.
You know, there's... Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, basically, my mom forwarded it to my dad, and the traffic doubled overnight. And then... 5 or 10 minutes a day. But the big break came a month later. I did a post called number 980, Old Dangerous Playground Equipment, and it got hit on the front page of Spark.com, and that day I got 50,000 hits.
Whoa!
1,000 hits. 2,000 people stayed. Yeah, 2,000 people stayed, so the next day I had 2,000 hits, and 2,000 hits. And every time my website would hit one of those big websites, like Big or Spark or Reddit, I noticed that 2,000 or 3,000 people stayed. So my daily readership grew and grew until it became 50,000 today. And I was passing, you know, 1 million, 10 million, 50 million. Then things compound. I get a phone call. The guy says, you won best blog in the world. I said, are you the Nigerian prince? New York City. And I walked the red carpet between Martha Stewart and Jimmy Fallon, and I accepted the best blog in the world award.
Wow.
I should do a TED Talk, which is on TED.com, the 3 A's of Awesome, about my story, and then that's on the Book of Awesome. Book of Awesome sold a million copies, and it's been the bestseller for over 200 weeks. But all these things just built on, you know, people like me looking for something small and short and positive, and a way to give themselves a break. And all those successes were all domino effects. You know, it really all started with the first blog post going viral a month in. And I had to have the stamina to do 1,000 days in a row, which I keep mentioning because that's 4 years of publishing an essay every day without missing a day.
Wow. That, yeah. That is kind of what reminds me of Malcolm, was it Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, about where he talks about people who seem to be these huge successes and have all this luck, but they put in the 10,000 hours to get there. So 1,000 essays, and if you were, you
that's
said...
Malcolm Gladwell's theory.
Pardon?
Yeah, sorry, I'm talking over you again. That's exactly his argument. Yeah. And I will also say, that was me. So I told you I worked for a newspaper in college. What I didn't tell you is I spent 40 hours a week on that newspaper for 4 years.
Wow.
Grew to the editor of that newspaper. So I did that, and then in high school I did the same thing. And so I had a lot of hours, a lot of time. And I read an interview once with Todd Hanson, and he was the editor of The Onion. And people always ask him, how do you get paid to be funny? How do you get paid to write jokes? And he said, you just do it for free for 10 years first.
That'll do it. And you just keep at it. And you said you spent, what, 5 hours per essay? Was that your average for this 1,000 days?
Yeah, it was about that because I was deathly single. You know, I didn't know anybody. I was living alone by myself for the first time. I'd get home from work at 5 o'clock, and I'd go straight at it till 2 in the morning. I published my blog at 12:01 a.m. every day, and I also was answering all the emails. I was also submitting my links to, like, you know, different websites. I was, like, sending it around. I was, like, if you or somebody asked me to do a radio interview for like 2 minutes in the middle of nowhere, I would always say like, wherever anyone wants. I did interviews with like high school newspapers, elementary school newspapers, anyone, anywhere that ever wanted to talk to me, I did.
And then you became an overnight success.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Neil, thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices with 2 Minute Mornings, a journal to win your day every day. I'm going to take this home with me, and I'm going to do it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm going to do it, and I'll let you know how my life changes. How's that?
I really appreciate that. Thanks for having me on the show. And by the way, I think it will. If it's anything like what it's doing for me, it's just so helpful every day to have a little bit of guidance. So good luck, and I hope it works well for you.
Thank you, and I think it will too. And Mom, do you have some closing words of wisdom for us today?
Did I have some closing? Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, how we spend our days is basically how we spend our lives.
And you can get a good start on your day with 2 Minute Mornings.
You betcha.
From Neil Pasricha, the founder of 1,000 Awesome Things. Check out his blog. It's a lot of fun. And stay tuned now, if you're listening on Friday, for Planet Earthwild. This interview will rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. If you're listening on Monday, have a great week. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.